The first case on calendar today is Cannarelli v. District Court. Are counsel ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
Please tell the clerk how much time you wish for rebuttal.
5 minutes, please. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Pickering. May it please the court, my name is Colby Williams. I represent the petitioners in this action. We're here today to address an issue that the lower courts, specifically the probate court and the discovery commissioner, quote, have struggled with for years, end quote. Those are not my words. Those are the words of Judge Sturman at the hearing below. And despite the fact that the district court has struggled with this issue, and despite the fact that both the district court and the discovery commissioner have both acknowledged that this court has never adopted the fiduciary exception to the attorney-client privilege, they have nonetheless employed that exception to compel the production of attorney-client privilege communications, not just in this case, but in many other probate cases. We submit that as error. And the primary reason that it is error is that Nevada's statutory attorney-client privilege, embodied in 49.095, contains no fiduciary exception. There are five exceptions to the attorney-client privilege outlined by the statute, and the fiduciary exception is not one of them. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more detail, but before I do, I want to first talk about the communications that we're here talking about today and why they're protected by the attorney-client privilege in the first instance. We're here talking about two sets of notes, as the court knows. The first set of notes, and these notes, I should say, were produced inadvertently in the litigation below out of Mr. Lover's hard file. The first set of notes we refer to in the briefing is the Group 1 notes. Those comprise four handwritten pages and one typed page. The second set of notes, which we refer to as the Group 2 notes, contain two handwritten pages. I am going to focus this presentation on the typed notes because I believe that is the crux of the party's dispute. But I'm happy to answer any questions about the other handwritten notes to the extent the court has any. And I'm going to refer to these notes in a general sense as opposed to revealing the content because I'd like to try to maintain the confidentiality of these notes. The lower court found the top third of the notes to be protected by the attorney-client privilege. The lower courts also found that no exception applied to that portion of the notes. And that
Can you address the notes? Can you address us to the appendix page of which particular notes? There's like five different sets.
Absolutely.
Of pages at issue. It'd be helpful.
Because of the briefing and the objections, the notes appear in several places. The typed notes most easily can be found under the sealed appendix, volume 1, page 74, where you can find the typed notes. They appear other places, but I know that they're there. After the top third of the notes, the district court then, and I should back up and say, we agree with the district court's finding as it relates to the top third of the notes. But the court went on to find that the remainder of the notes, with the exception of the last sentence, are subject to production for three reasons. They found that the notes address trust administration matters and thus are subject to production under the fiduciary exception we're here to talk about. The district court found that the notes in that section comprise facts for which Scott had shown a substantial need to obtain on account of Mr. Lover's death and unavailability for deposition. And the final basis for production was NRS 49.115, subsection 5, which I refer to as the joint client exception to the attorney-client privilege. We submit all three of those findings are error. With respect to the privileged nature of the typed notes, we're really only talking about one element of the attorney-client privilege that's in dispute. And that is, were these typed notes communicated to counsel? Did Mr. Lover's...
I'm going to pause you there for just a minute.
Sure.
Is there a bit of a disconnect between what the commissioner found and what the district court found with respect to attorney-client privilege for the whole of 74?
I think there's absolutely a disconnect in the following sense. Although they ended up at the same place, the district court took a circuitous route getting there. It was a bit of a roller coaster because if you look, and I think this is most clearly exhibited in findings 3 and 4 of the judge's order, because in paragraph 3, Judge Sturman says there's no evidence to show that, quote, any portion of the notes were communicated to counsel. that the discovery commissioner had made assumptions on that basis. Now, we disagree with that, but if you look at the very next finding, finding four, Judge Sterman says, but I agree with the discovery commissioner that the first top third of the notes reflect the types of things a trustee would talk about with his or her counsel, and thus I find that that section of the notes is protected by the privilege, which of course necessitates the existence of a communication. So,
right. So, and as I read the commissioner's analysis, it seemed to me she was saying the whole is ostensibly attorney-client privilege protected, but I'm going to apply the fiduciary exception to some portion of the otherwise wholly protected, whereas the district court kind of equivocates and then says, well...
The district court did equivocate, Your Honor, but I think at the end of the day, the only thing the district court ultimately changed, despite those two inconsistent findings I talked about, the only thing the district court deviated from the discovery commissioner on related to one of the handwritten notes, Bates number 132.
Right. The actual result is different.
Right. The rest of the findings, she upheld the rest of the findings. Now, it's tough when you get through it because there was a lot of, and I'll just call it what it is, there was a lot of inconsistency with respect to what the district court said both at the time of hearing and ultimately what got incorporated into this order. But my position with respect to the communication is we presented more than substantial evidence to show that there was a communication between Mr. Lovers and his counsel.
As to the whole of
something. As to the whole. And we've summarized that evidence for you in our brief. I can quickly tick off some of it. If you look at the notes themselves, referring to them generally, they start off with a handwritten date. The date is October the 14th, 2013. No dispute that Mr. Lovers had an attorney-client communication with his lawyers on that day. That is corroborated by the billing records of the Lee Hernandez law firm showing a lengthy call between counsel and Mr. Lovers about the petition that day. If you continue looking at the notes, answering Justice Pickering's questions about the totality of them, they start off asking questions about the petitions, seeking legal advice. They then go on to express Mr. Lovers' beliefs about the way the district court may view the case, about where there may be risk in the case, about his strategy with respect to the way certain things should be handled. Quintessential attorney-client subject matter. Attorneys Lee and Renwick, to the extent that they could, provided declarations corroborating the existence of the phone call on that day, that they talked about these subjects, and they identified the general subjects. But of course I couldn't have them come in and say, this is exactly what we talked about, because I would be at risk of waiving the privilege. So I did what I could in that regard. And finally, the next day, October the 15th, 2013, Attorney Renwick sent a letter to Scott's counsel at the time saying, we've been retained, we've reviewed the petitions, and we've discussed them with counsel. I would submit discussions are synonymous with communications. Now, the law in this area is clear. Those notes didn't have to be physically delivered to counsel in order to be deemed privileged. The key is whether the contents were communicated. And the law is equally clear that outlines of topics that a client wishes to discuss with counsel are to be considered privileged if the other elements of the privilege are met, and we submit they are here. To the extent the district court found that the notes contained facts, a proposition with which we disagree, but even if they did, this court has repeatedly recognized, we all get that facts are discoverable, but facts contained in a privileged communication seeking the advice of counsel don't get disclosed. The communication remains protected. The Wynn case, the Wardley case, the Upjohn case from the U.S. Supreme Court all stand for that proposition. I'm running out of time, but I want to, before my rebuttal time starts, I'd like to quickly hit the fiduciary exception and why I don't believe it exists in the state of Nevada. As we all know, the attorney-client privilege is statutory, NRS 49.095. The exceptions to the attorney-client privilege are statutory, 49.115. Excuse me, I said 49.095 is the privilege itself. There are five enunciated exceptions. The fiduciary exception is not one of them. This court has recognized forever the statutory construction principle that the expression of one thing is the exclusion of another. Here, the legislature recognized five exceptions. It excluded the fiduciary exception. Under this court, the court can look to the Supreme Courts of Texas, California, and Oregon, who have all addressed this exact issue in a statutory framework nearly identical to Nevada's, and they have all rejected the attorney-client, the fiduciary exception to the privilege. And those cases, most respectfully, were never addressed by Scott in his answering brief. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Justice Pickering, and may it please the court. I'm going to start off on the attorney-client privilege because I think it is essential to the ruling by this court, because without a privilege, you never even get to the fiduciary exception. And in referencing the report and recommendation first, which is in the appendix, I know multiple times, but I'm going to refer to page 477 to 489. I disagree with Mr. Williams a bit as to what the Discovery Commissioner found. She did not base her decision basically primarily on the fiduciary exception, nor did Judge Sturman. Rather, if you look on page 5 of 13, which is at 481 of the report and recommendation, there's really two key parts to the type notes. The first that begins with the indentation with the word first and goes through the word happen. I'm going to refer to as the distribution statements, just for the record, and then the part that begins with the word whether and goes through actual is I'm going to refer to as the sales statements. With respect to the distribution statements, the court specifically stated that they were facts in nature and therefore subject to disclosure. She went on to say it may constitute work product, never found it did, but said to the extent that it does constitute work product, there is a substantial need. To the extent there is a privilege, then it's governed by the fiduciary exception. Likewise, with respect to the distribution statements, she held that they are subject to disclosure because they are factual in nature. And that's on the bottom of page 5 on the report and recommendation. She also says that there are, because they're factual, there is substantial need for disclosure of the same, and to the extent this portion may be protected under the attorney-client privilege, then it's subject to the fiduciary exception. So I agree wholeheartedly as to what the Discovery Commission even found, because she found they were not privileged at all and never actually made a finding that it was in fact protected, but said to the extent. And that was a large reason why Judge Sturman said that there were a lot of assumptions made by the Discovery Commissioner relative to the communication, and why her order ultimately states that certain portion of the typed notes are based upon assumptions and a lack of evidence that any portion of the document was actually communicated to counsel. So it's our position that the entire document is not protected at all because they have failed to show a communication. And I rely a lot upon DeFonte.
Counsel?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but how would they definitively established that these exact points were discussed without breaching attorney-client privilege by doing so?
I'm glad you asked that question, because there are several things they could have done. They obviously rely upon circumstantial evidence, which you could draw reasonable inferences, but if you draw all reasonable inferences, including those in favor of our client, and look at the lack of direct evidence. For starters, I believe if you read the declarations of both Ms. Remlick and Mr. Lee, that they have independent knowledge. They state what they recall being talked about. They don't need to refresh their recollection. So because they have independent recollection, I don't think anything precluded them from reviewing their file. Also, petitioner's counsel, excuse me, refer to petitioner and respondent the opposite way in probate, but the petitioner's counsel could have reviewed the file to see if the notes were contained therein and could have...
No, of course they could know whether specific items were discussed. My question is whether they would file something with the court that says, we definitely discussed points A, B, and C from this page of notes without... having a problem with whatever privilege may remain.
They could disclose the subject matter so long as the content of the subject matter. So we would submit that they could have disclosed the subject matter of the sales statements that I refer to in the type notes and the subject matter of the distribution statements without disclosing actually the content. that could have easily been done. But going back to the point, and I apologize for misunderstanding your question, but the other evidence that they could have presented that is clearly lacking, in our opinion, which would have been direct evidence, is petitioner's counsel could have reviewed the attorney's file to determine if the notes were in there and determine whether or not the attorney's notes were referenced the sales statements or the distribution statements. And I don't think by, again, staying to the topics or the subject matters, it would have been a waiver of any sort of the attorney-client privilege. They could have looked at Ed's computer and the metadata on the document to see when it was created and whether or not it was even created by Lovers, because I know that was an issue potentially raised by the Discovery Commissioner. They could have looked through Mr. Lovers' emails and seen whether or not it was ever sent. They could have done a number of things. Mr. Williams or his co-counsel could have had a conversation with Mr. Lee and Ms. Renwick and asked the subject matters that they discussed. And those subject matters then could have been included within a declaration. Because in the U.S. Gimenez case, Your Honor, which I think is significant, and again cited by them, the court did find the application of the privilege and relied heavily upon the DeFonte case, which in turn relied heavily upon the Burnick and Clark case. And in each one of those cases, the court said, and I use the key words, that central to the finding was that there was an actual communication between the client and the attorney. And in the Jimenez case, the attorney actually submitted a declaration after reviewing the emails that were subject to question and confirmed that the legal strategy and the discussions with the client were geared towards and specifically aimed at the contents of those emails. And again, going back to the refresh the recollection, I believe when you look at the declarations that they had independent knowledge. So I don't believe anything would have precluded them from looking at their file. But again,
But the Discovery Commissioner, I have to beg to differ with you. The Discovery Commissioner does find that the first few paragraphs up to the indented first was attorney-client privilege. In other words, she credits that Lovers and attorney himself was making notes preparatory to a call with his counsel as to the subject that he wished to discuss with counsel. And to me, it follows from the rest of this that it's all of a piece. I don't think you have to, if you're preparing for a conference with a counsel as a client, and you jot down all the things you want to cover with your lawyer, and you go through them and use that as a working list, I don't find any authority for splitting that single list of the case preparation call.
Well, let me answer.
And that seems to me to be the proposition you're advancing.
Not entirely, Your Honor. First of all, the Discovery Commissioner's findings at the top portion, I believe, were based upon assumption and speculation, as Judge Sturman noted.
But you said that the Discovery Commissioner found none of it to be attorney-client privilege.
I apologize if I misspoke. I was specifically referring to what I was referring to as the distribution statements and the sales statement, which is the person or the part that begins with the word first and goes through the paragraph.
But my question still stands. How can you have an internal memo to yourself of things you want to talk about with your lawyer preparatory to a conference call, and the first half is privileged, and then the second half you're asking for proof that you read that aloud to your lawyer? I mean, what is the proof you want for that?
Well, Your Honor, the law requires proof. The law requires that they meet their burden by showing that there was an actual communication.
But they did. They showed a phone call and billing time, and certainly the court was convinced the first half of this memo was covered. I
quarrel with the words convinced a little bit, because she said these appear to be the type of questions that one would ask their attorney, therefore I'm finding them privileged. That doesn't demonstrate that there was an actual communication. And if you look at the billing records, you have less than a half hour call, 0.40, which is between 19 and 14 minutes. You have three different petitions that were filed, and the billing record, the description is lengthy telephone call regarding intention for hearings on petitions filed by Scott Canarelli and issues regarding clarification. Okay, you have three different petitions, three different trusts, three different terms of the trust. You have two different trustees who are requesting an accounting, an inventory, disclosure of documents, and appraisal. All four of those are administrative in nature. Okay? The issues that were requiring clarification are easily determined by the response that they filed, as well as the stipulation in order. And those issues of clarification related to the length of the accounting, as far as how far it had to go back, and what the time period was for the disclosure of it. If you look at the three pages of the handwritten notes that Mr. Williams referred to, that Lubbers did handwrite during that conversation, with the attorneys on that day. If you do a comparison to those three pages of handwritten notes in connection with the typed notes, you are going to see very little, if any, overlap, which if you're looking for an inference, that inference was it was not discussed. And again, I go back to what the lack of evidence is. How come we don't have a declaration, again, by a review of the file stating that the notes were in there or it was subject to the attorney's notes in the files? Why don't we have a declaration on the actual subject matters that are being disclosed?
Mr. Wiggins, let me ask you one other issue. I understand your point on that. On NRS 49.115, Mr. Counsel for the appellant or petitioner here is arguing that the fiduciary exception is not within the statute, so the absence of that indicates the intent is not to be included by the legislature. So what's your position regarding Mr. Williams' argument?
I obviously disagree with it, and I'll move on to the fiduciary exception because of the time.
Tell me legally.
First of all, that wasn't the sole basis. It was one of the basis. And I put the common interest equivalent to essentially the Charleston v. Hardesty decision without, however, the fiduciary duty and the extension of it. We know that Charleston v. Hardesty has essentially been overruled by statute that now says that an attorney for a trustee, vis-a-vis that relationship between the trustee and the beneficiary, does not owe a fiduciary duty. But I think the statute is akin to that without the fiduciary duty relationship. So that's where the common interest is. It's because of the special relationship between the beneficiary and the trustee. And when you look at it in the context of these petitions, realistically, the legal advice that Mr. Lubbers should have been seeking would have been to benefit the trust, i.e. provide an accounting, provide an inventory, provide a request for documents. But I don't think that's the main basis for accepting the fiduciary exception, and I think it should be adopted by this court. And I know the Discovery Commissioner relied upon the Marshall versus 8th Judicial District decision, and it was referenced in petitioner's brief as well. Ironically, I'm sure you're aware that Justice Pickering and Justice Givens, you were on the panel of that decision, as well as Judge Kadish.
It was reversed.
You did, but for a different reason. For a different reason. And in that opinion, the court specifically said a beneficiary's right to a trustee's attorney file flows from the trustee's fiduciary duties to the beneficiary casting the beneficiary as a client. So I would say that you've already implicitly at least shown a tendency of the court to go that way. You also cited NRS 165-180, which empowers the district court to require the trustees to give beneficiaries information and complete and full disclosure, as well as citing Scott on Trust and Restatement of Trust Third, which both provide that the advice and the opinions of counsel of a trustee are subject to disclosure to the beneficiary as long as it relates to the administration of the trust. And there's the two lines of thoughts, essentially, on the fiduciary exception. You have one, the client is the beneficiary, and two, you have the duty of full disclosure. I would urge the court to adopt the second aspect of it for several different reasons, which I'll get to in a minute as far as policy. But this court has always said, obviously, you construe privileges very narrowly, and in doing so, you have stated whether recognize that privileges, regardless of whether or not they're creatures of statute or the common law, should be construed narrowly. And despite their authority that there's no ambiguity in the attorney-client privilege statute that would preclude you from looking at legislative history, this court has done so in the Mitchell versus 8th Judicial Court case, even though there was no ambiguity. But more importantly, I think, in the Thomas versus Nevada Yellow Cab corporation, this court raised the issue that when you have two statutes or parts of the law that you can't harmonize with one another, you need to look at the legislative history. And I would submit that you have the attorney-client privilege statute, and then you have NRS 165-180 and its common law counterpart that this court has always said requires a trustee to provide full and adequate disclosure. You have to harmonize those together.
But isn't that a legislative function? If they want to create an exception, they do. And haven't we hesitated and rejected, in fact, creating judicial exceptions or judicially created exceptions to other statutory privileges, for instance, TIVOL?
I would agree, Your Honor. However, where I distinguish it, and all the courts that essentially have applied the fiduciary exception distinguish it, is the exception is essentially a misnomer. It's not an exception to the attorney-client privilege. It's an extension of the privilege to the beneficiary, because that privilege still exists via the third parties, whereas an exception, it does not.
Doesn't NRS 162.310 say that that's not the case?
No, that refers specifically to whether or not an attorney owes a fiduciary duty to a beneficiary vis-a-vis the fact that they represent a trustee. And that statute was directly meant to overrule Hardesty. But just because I'm out of time, I would urge the court, in looking at all the policy reasons that are set forth in the cases for the adoption of the fiduciary exception, and it not only has to do with the duty of full disclosure, but if and I may make this one point, is that sometimes you might have a situation where a trustee is obtaining advice for the benefit of the beneficiary, but what if they don't follow that advice and there's damage to the beneficiary? You have that situation where they're not relying upon the advice of counsel as a defense, therefore there's no waiver, and that might be the only evidence available to show that, for the beneficiary to show that the trustee breached the fiduciary duty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I've got a lot to cover, so I'll try and get to it quickly. With respect to the underlying order by the Discovery Commissioner, page 4, this is at the appendix, third volume, joint appendix 480, very bottom of the page. The handwritten date is consistent with the date Lovers consulted with his lawyers, and the notes reflect the types of things one would discuss with his slash her attorney. The typed notes, therefore, appear to be an attorney-client communication. The typed notes, not a part of the typed notes, the typed notes. The court then did go on to find exceptions that required the production of other parts of those notes, but we would submit that the Discovery Commissioner found the notes in their entirety to be protected. With respect to whether Mr. Lovers created these notes, we think the evidence is very clear that he created the notes that came out of his hard file. That's been admitted by counsel. But more importantly, what also has been admitted by counsel or argued by counsel throughout the proceedings below is that these are admissions of Edward Lovers. They want to use these to support the expansion of their case. They can't be admissions of Mr. Lovers if they aren't his notes. So I don't think there's any legitimate dispute about who created these notes. With respect to the disclosure obligations of a fiduciary, we aren't saying that the rejection of the fiduciary exception is going to do away with the disclosure obligations owed by a trustee to a beneficiary. Absolutely not. If you read the Wells Fargo case from the Supreme Court of California, as well as the Huey case from the Supreme Court of Texas, they dealt with this exact issue. And the issue was, are you saying that the disclosure obligations of a trustee override the attorney-client privilege? And the court said, no. But that doesn't mean that the trustee still independently doesn't have those obligations. If Mr. Lovers was found to have breached those, then those consequences will be whatever they are. But it doesn't mean that he loses the benefit of the attorney-client privilege. And with respect to the issue of the misnomer theory, that is exactly what 162.310, in my view, addresses, which is the argument in Riggs, which is sort of the preeminent case that adopted the fiduciary exception, because Delaware is a common law state with respect to the privilege, at least at the time Riggs was decided. What Riggs said was that we're going to find that the real client here is not the trustee, but the beneficiary. And that's why we are comfortable extending the scope of the privilege to the beneficiary. Well, obviously, we don't have a common law privilege here, but more importantly, we do have 162.310, which says when the attorney represents the fiduciary, here the trustee, Mr. Lovers, that attorney doesn't then take on a concomitant fiduciary duty to the beneficiary. The law is clear on that. So the real client theory of Riggs cannot apply in Nevada based on the Nevada statutes. Next. With respect to construing privileges narrowly, no argument there. We understand that. But what the court can't do is narrow a privilege through the adoption of an exception that doesn't exist in statute. For example, here's a good example of construing a privilege narrowly was the Rogers opinion that we cited dealing with the physician-patient privilege authored by Chief Justice Pickering. There, what the party wanted the court to do was to expand the statutory definition of physician to include first responders and made some pretty good policy arguments as to why that made sense. But the court said that is a policy line drawn by the legislature. We can't redraw that line. If the legislature wants to, knock yourself out. Same thing with Mitchell. In Mitchell, again, authored by Chief Justice Pickering, what the party wanted to do there was to import a limitation to one of the exceptions to the physician-patient privilege, which would have expanded the scope of the privilege. And the court said, we are not going to read into the physician-patient privilege a limitation that doesn't exist. So too here. I respectfully submit the court cannot read in a fiduciary exception into the attorney-client privilege that doesn't exist. And I'll close with this. How do we prove whether the communications were privileged or not? Justice Kadish. This state has made a policy determination that the attorney-client privilege is going to survive death. 49.105 specifically states that the decedent's personal representative can assert the privilege. You're, in that situation, you're never going to have a client that's able to come in and tell you the facts surrounding it. And you can't have the attorney come in and waive it either. You're going to have to do it based with circumstantial evidence, which takes me to the Met case from the Nevada, from the Ninth Circuit, which says hard cases get resolved in favor of the privilege, not disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Justice Hardesty has a question.
Yes, Justice.
I understand your arguments, both sides, with respect to the type notes.
Yes.
And even with respect to some of the handwritten notes. But in looking at some of the handwritten notes, and just for the record, 75, 76, 77, and 79, to the extent that I'm able to read the handwritten notes, I struggle to understand what about those notes and their contents are privileged. How the arguments you've been making with respect to the type notes apply, and I'd like to be more specific.
Absolutely.
With respect to each one of those pages, because my reading of these, and I'm not nearly as close to the case as you folks are,
sure,
calls into question what is privileged about a couple of these notations.
I think I can address that very quickly, Your Honor. And let me make a distinction between the Group 1 notes, the handwritten pages there, and then the Group 2 notes. Because with Group 2, prepared in December, we've only argued work product. So we've never argued that those were privileged. But let me focus on the ones you raised. Okay. And I think it's quickly and easily addressed with the following, Your Honor. Scott's counsel has acknowledged repeatedly in the lower court proceedings, in fact, used the language, there's no dispute that those notes were prepared by Mr. Lovers during his call with the lawyers on the 14th of October, 2013. In other words, there is no dispute in the record that those were prepared while Mr. Lovers was on the phone with his lawyers recording what was being said at the time, in which case I don't think there's any dispute that those would be covered by the attorney-client privilege, setting aside what the content may or may not be.
Well, and then if you could address the notes to which you sought
the group
protection.
Two
yes. Your opponent seems to disagree with you about this question about the need and whether they're covered by work product or not. I'd like you to address your viewpoint on that.
Absolutely. So obviously when we're talking about work product, the first issue is to establish that they were prepared in anticipation of litigation or because of litigation. I think we've shown that given the nature of the petition, the adversarial nature of some of the allegations, the fact that litigation had been threatened by Scott's lawyers. So I think we've met that. Unless Your Honor wants me to address that further, I will. But with respect to the notes themselves, those were notes that were taken by Mr. Lovers at a meeting with an independent valuation consultant named Steve Nicolatis. I was present at that meeting. My co-counsel was present at the meeting. Mr. Lovers was there. Scott was there with his counsel, and there was another employee there from American West Homes. And Mr. Lovers took notes. Our position is their work product, the finding of the discovery commissioner, as argued by Scott, was that there's a substantial need for those notes. Our position on that is as follows.
I didn't get a chance to ask Mr. Wiggins, why weren't there other, why couldn't you depose other people in the media?
Precisely. Thank you. That was my argument below, which is
first at least.
Number one, Scott was there, so he saw what went on at the meeting. Uh-huh. But you could certainly, as a starting point, take the depositions of, for example, Bob Evans, the employee from American West who was there, or Steve Nicolatis, the consultant who was there.
Okay.
My argument is that there wasn't substantial need for that reason.
Thank you, Chief.
Your Honor, may I respond to that question?
Sure.
Yes, you may.
If the Chief says yes.
In fairness, he went on for some additional time, so could you please give her an additional 2 minutes and 39 seconds?
Thank you, Justice. I appreciate it. In regards to the substantial need, mm-hmm. And whether or not we could depose other individuals, I think this is a very unique situation. You have Mr. Lovers, who's not only a material witness, he's a party to the litigation. He was our fiduciary at that point in time and the family trustee. I don't think that you could substitute his testimony, and Mr. Williams said it, we contend that those statements that are factual in nature regarding the distributions and the sale are admissions of a party opponent. You cannot substitute admissions of a party opponent with a co-defendant, which we're suing for fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. I don't think that is the substantial equivalent, which is what the law requires in that regard. And then going back, since I have a little more time on the Charleston.
But your client himself was at that meeting, correct?
With regard to the group two notes, I was talking in general. I apologize about all of the notes, more specifically the type notes.
Talk about the group two notes.
Well, I think the whole substantial need applies to all of it across the board.
The substantial need on the group two notes. I asked him to talk about each of the separate notes. I mean, you folks, the briefing here focuses an awful lot on the type notes, and we're throwing around legal concepts that are pretty significant. There are a series of notes that were adjudicated here, and I think we should focus on those notes separately. So my question was particularized to the group two notes.
My answer would be the same, Your Honor. I mean, the reason why there's been no focus on them is because both parties have recognized that the type notes are really the critical notes that are the central issue of the motion.
So the others move, we don't have to address them?
Your Honor, to be honest, I don't think either party really cares about those group two notes.
Oh, so we can disregard that in our disposition.
If you would like to disregard the group two notes and the Nicolatis notes, I personally have no preference. I think the rest of the notes are critical and the real reason why we're here.
Is that a concession?
I will not concede that there's no substantial need relating to them because I think the substantial need applies across the board with respect to all of the notes.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out what's the substantial need for notes and taken during a meeting in which a whole bunch of other people, including your folks, are present. When I practiced, we first had to take the testimony of the folks who were there before we got into access.
I agree, and that is normally the standard, and I think with respect to group two notes, I would acknowledge that that's probably the better course. With respect to the type notes, absolutely not, because those contain different information.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
In regards to the Charleston v. Hardesty, I dispute the fact that that somehow rejects the client as a beneficiary. My firm was actually instrumental in drafting that statute before the legislation, and it was directly meant to overrule Charleston v. Hardesty and the fact that the fiduciary duty extends. Again, by extending the fiduciary exception and who is subject to that privilege, you don't have to extend the fiduciary aspect of it to the attorney vis-a-vis the beneficiary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for their arguments and presentations. They were excellent. The matter will stand submitted and will be at ease until the next case comes forward.